Hello everyone, and thank you. It's great to be here. I've come a long way and it's definitely been worth the journey. Not only have I gotten to meet some of the people who've influenced my work, but I've seen some familiar faces from the past. What I'm focusing on in my presentation is not so much the domestic Mr. Bigs or the local Mr. Littles who've gone seriously bad. So not VAT fraudsters, not returned foreign fighters and their money. I'm looking at a different set of transnational criminals. In particular, those people who perpetrate or benefit from grand corruption. So if we want to give them an acronym, PEPs and their associates and relatives. Now, if we think back to the origins of some of this, of the conflicts that are going on in the Middle East right now, we'll remember that they started with the Arab Spring. And more recently, at least that's one juncture in time that we can take as a reference point. We'll also remember the conflicts in a place that I spent some time in recently, Ukraine, last year. Well, what we often forget when we're thinking about these crises is that they've generated or resulted in the freezing of assets in developed countries due to their connections with the leaders in these fallen regimes. The last figure I heard was that $1 billion worth of assets is sitting frozen in states like Switzerland and the UK. Now, the new governments understandably want this money back, and in theory it should be easy. They convict the perpetrators, they get a confiscation order, they send it to the haven states to enforce. Well, as we all know, whatever starts with in theory ends with it's not so easy in practice. And as we find 4 years after the Arab Spring, a lot of that money, most of it, is still sitting frozen in Swiss bank accounts. Well, this state of affairs has strengthened calls from international organisations and states for the lowering of barriers to recovery. And, of course, one of the things on that list, they relate to those kind of procedural devices that we're familiar with in our work, reverse burdens of proof, lower standards of proof, delay, political will. But one of the items on the list is individual rights. There is concern that claims could be brought in public law in either the victim or the haven jurisdiction that would inhibit the return of assets. Now, this was the broad picture that I looked at when I undertook my PhD research at the University of Basel. That finished in 2012, and it's recently, my thesis has been published as a book with Cambridge, which is out there if anyone's interested. So, what did I ask? This was my research question. Do states violate international civil and political rights when they cooperate for the purposes of asset recovery? Well, like all thesis questions, it sounds a little bit abstract and convoluted when you put it like that. What I essentially did was two things. First, I identified the types of measures that states are required to take or encouraged to take under the anti-corruption treaties to engage in asset recovery. And then I compared those measures, analysed them, through the jurisprudence of the regional human rights tribunals. Now, the findings from the ECHR, the European Court of Human Rights, are particularly relevant for our discussion on effectiveness of proceeds of crime and counter-terrorist financing regimes. And it's not just because we're here in the UK that has the Human Rights Act. I would argue that this type of discourse or discussion will also be relevant to states that are outside that particular legal space, maybe looking at how to interpret their public law guarantees for rights like property and due process. In addition, there's another aspect to effectiveness that came out through my research, and that is that values like the rule of law, governance, even human rights, are identified as part of the interests that these transnational crime conventions, these suppression conventions, are supposed to protect. So if what we're doing to regain or recover wealth is undermining those interests, we have a problem. We're actually not doing what it is that we set out to do. So I won't go into the definitions in detail, save to note that what we talk about when we talk about it, asset recovery at an international level, is probably a bit different to what we understand it to be at the national level. It's not defined well in the international legal system. It means both a goal, moving that relates to the movement of assets through the international financial system, as well as the regaining of those assets. So as Professor Aldridge has already noted, who actually owns those things in the first place is very much differs from case to case. It's also a catch-all asset recovery for the legal processes that contribute to the second objective of regaining assets when they are moved abroad. And of those processes, I was particularly concerned with cooperative confiscation. Right, so the European standards and cases. Well, what I discovered when I looked into the European case law was that asset recovery, given that it's a new issue, hasn't yet been considered in this particular type of asset recovery, so cooperative confiscation, hasn't been considered by the European Court of Human Rights. Nonetheless, there is a case that is quite close authority, and it is that of Sacochia in Austria. Now, Mr. Sacochia was a large-scale money launderer. He did a bit of work for some South American drug cartels. Ultimately, the feds caught up with him, convicted him of money laundering, obtained a forfeiture order for about $100 million, I think. Now, they discovered in the courses of their investigation that Mr. Sacochia had some bearer bonds, assets, various sorts in Vienna. So they sent their forfeiture order over to the Austrians and with a request that it be enforced. The Austrians obliged, but Mr. Sacochia challenged the enforcement of the order through the Austrian court system and all the way to Strasbourg. He had a little bit of luck or success in Strasbourg. He got through at the admissibility stage, but we're not surprised to hear he failed on the merits. What did the first section find? Well, it found that Austria had complied with Article 1 of the first protocol, that is the right to property, as well as Article 6 and Article 7 of the main convention on the right to a fair trial and freedom from retrospective penalties. For one thing, the Austrian enforcement order wasn't a penalty and it wasn't retrospective because at the time of the offence, money laundering was punishable with forfeiture under US law. Not only that, but the enforcement proceedings in Austria were fair. The Austrian courts had duly satisfied themselves that the US proceedings were up to the fair trial standards in the legal space of the convention, so under Article 6. And they'd also given Mr. Sacochia, in these proceedings, an opportunity to challenge the enforcement of the order. So for this reason, the court was comfortable that the enforcement of the order was procedurally proportionate under Article 1. It was also not so broad, substantively so large in scope as to be disproportionate. And the Austrian court's developmental interpretation, let's say, of its MLA law was not so broad or so advanced as to violate the requirement of legality. Now, I've titled this slide Consistency and Ambiguity because one of my findings, the findings of my research, was that Sacochia is quite a densely / sketchily argued case. There's quite a lot in it, but what it says only really becomes clear when you read it closely and in the context of the ECHR's other case law on confiscation matters, cooperation matters, and conflicts of norm in international law. The problem is that these cases are also ambiguous. So what we have in effect is an existent but uncertain regulatory framework for state, national level, public law restraint on cooperative confiscations and confiscations in particular. Now I think, I'm not sure how I'm going on time, but 5 minutes, okay. So I'll just move through these points very quickly. The first point to note, and it comes back to what we were talking about earlier, is that the case law on Article 1, confiscations under Article 1 and Article 6, does give reason to conclude that at least some illicit wealth will be considered possessions. So much is clear. And at least some confiscation cases will be compatible with Article 6 and the procedural requirements of Article 1. That said, as I've already mentioned, the reasoning of the court is quite unclear. What seems to be certain is that rights to a defence are crucial. substantive proportionality comes into it, as does the fact that a confiscation order affects third parties. But these, just as matters that the court considers in an overall appraisal of the proportionality of the order. Second, we can expect even less supervision of confiscation orders when they take the form of enforcement orders within a haven state from abroad. It's promising in a way that Sacochia confirms that these orders will be within, that enforcement orders are within the scope of the European Convention on Human Rights, even though they are to some extent extraterritorial. But it's not yet clear to what extent the court will attenuate, wind back the convention standards, given that the proceedings are cooperative. So does the flagrant denial of justice test, which the ECHR set out in Zurich, also apply to the property guarantees? How would it affect, for example, a claim of a violation, an extraterritorial violation of a right to privacy? These matters remain to be determined. Moreover, we have the issue of, I'd say, a conflict of norms or a conflict of interests that is elided in Sacochia and Austria. And that issue will become more prominent if and as the ECHR and national courts decide issues regarding the conflict of the interests of peoples who are the purported beneficiaries of asset recovery measures and of individuals, PEPs, their relatives and associates, who claim a right to property in fair proceedings, even if their entitlement appears to be quite tenuous. So that's the black letter summary, taking the theme of talking both to practitioners and academics. This is how Sacochia looks in the wash-up for future cases. There's no case directly on point, but we have substantial related jurisprudence, and respondent states have the capacity to succeed if they act proportionately and lawfully. The bigger issue is whether the court's approach is contributing to a discussion of effectiveness of asset recovery and confiscation measures at a local and, let's say, a transnational level. In my view, the answer depends very much on what you conceive of as particular human rights and the role of human rights tribunals and systems in the development of national law. I would argue that property rights in particular are mechanisms for the discussion of rules for the discussion of rules that govern access to resources within and increasingly across jurisdictions. So the failure of the ECHR to clearly enunciate or to tell states how they should be mediating these interests is something of a failure. It amounts to something of a missed opportunity for the court to embrace its function as an arbiter of these conflicting international and local interests. Mm-hmm.